You're listening to Phil and Ted's Sexy Boomer Show, and our special guest, Ari Gross, is here with us. And guess what, Phil?
What?
It's pledge time.
Oh, no. Okay, I pledge allegiance to the...
Yeah, I wish. I wish it was that simple. And so we're raising money for this poor station that is desperately in need.
Yeah, we need air conditioning.
We need air conditioning.
Sure.
Yeah.
And talking about breathing in and breathing out, you know.
Yeah. If someone would donate an air conditioner to the air studio,
wouldn't that be nice? Yes.
Ari, we're getting ahead of ourselves here, but one of the premiums we're offering are tickets to see the show you're starring in right now called Birds of North America.
That's right, Birds of North America.
At Odyssey Theater, which I had the pleasure of seeing and loved.
Thanks.
I loved it.
Thank you.
And it's so appropriate for the Sexy Boomer Show, because to me it was a real boomer story.
It is. I mean, boomer and, would she be Gen X or millennial?
Well,
it's a father and daughter.
It's a father
and his adult daughter, yeah.
And it's just the two of you on stage and in one set, which is the backyard of your home in Baltimore.
Correct.
And you're birders. You're both, and your bonding between this father and this daughter is a shared love for birding that obviously the father taught the daughter.
Right.
And this is a series of conversations between the father and daughter over a 10-year period.
Correct.
Just vignettes.
Yeah, we see them one day a year in the fall. You know, at the beginning of each scene, it's, in the first scene, it's the fall. And then the scene two is the next fall.
Or after the fall, if you
will. Yeah, I fall later on, but
oh, you do.
And actually, I'm going to see After the Fall later this week.
Wow, amazing! How did I know?
Or maybe
that?
A View from the Bridge. I can't remember which
one.
Wow. But we see them. We see how this relationship moves over a 10-year period, and it all kind of there's this principal activity of birding.
Yeah,
bird but watching. It's what comes out. It's the kind of small talk between things where we start to see the contour of their lives and the sort of essence of their conflicts with one another.
I found it very powerful. First of all, the sound design was beautiful.
Yeah.
Very delicate, but really nice. But what I found, the reason I thought it was a great boomer story is because I married late in life and I have a single daughter who's now in college, as do you. She's not in college yet.
She's in high school, but same thing.
So we're kind of in that same boat. And so when I'm watching your character trying to relate to this growing young lady and the challenges of her learning about her dad as she grows up and realizes he's not perfect, he's not idyllic. He has failed in certain ways. And
that part's like falling off a log for me.
Well, I think for all fathers.
Yeah, that's right.
I just found it was so, I just really hit home. Not directly, even though my wife is a surgeon, a doctor.
Oh, interesting.
I'm not. I just play one on the radio, but your character is a doctor too. And it was just very interesting, the dynamic between the daughter and the father. I felt like I had real insight into it because I'm living it. I'm fortunate that I don't have the same dysfunctional issues that those two characters have.
I have plenty of my own.
But one thing that I am able to do that I felt that your character, I realized that your character was unable to do through this entire play was ever at one time, the two characters never said, "I love you."
Yes.
And I thought that was really profound because that's something we don't oversay it, but we always do say it.
Right.
And it's really important. And it was as if this poor father was unable to emotionally reach out to, it's just a great story.
So I would say that while John, that's my fellow's name, while John never says those words, "I love you," I feel like in every scene he says it in the way that he knows how to.
Yes.
Or is able to.
But and he's just we're talking about different realities here. He makes a statement with an intention of loving kindness, mm-hmm. and she takes it as a as an affront, uh-huh. And vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so. I wish I could go into 5 hours of depth right now about how brilliant the writing. Oh, Anna Uyang Munch wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote on Severance.
Oh.
She's
really?
Currently, wow. I believe, writing the second season of Beef.
Oh, no kidding. I've just been watching
She wrote Man
that.
Of God.
Wow.
I know there are big commissions she's got coming up. So you're going to be hearing about her a lot more. But the play, while the language isn't poetic, she writes like a poet.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I discovered, when you're learning a play, you kind of start with like, well, what's going on in the scene?
Yeah.
And then what's happening
what's your
in this chunk?
Right.
And then you start to learn the lines. But then there's a point in rehearsal where you start to like nail down the absolute exact syntax.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when it started to hit me that in every scene, we're of course birding, and that's the principal activity.
Mm.
But I may have a particular topic, like a particular thing that's on my mind to talk to my daughter about. And then I'll realize that everything else that I talk about, the language, the words that she chooses to use, all reverberate with the topic.
Mm-hmm.
At a certain point, there are issues around pregnancy and fertility.
Mm-hmm.
And before we get to any of that in the scene, I'm talking about things like I say, are you kidding me? I realize I'm talking about soccer. It's very low scoring. If people aren't scoring enough, there's a certain issue here. All the language kind of refers to. I talk about
entendre.
Yes, but it's all over the place. There's issues about like, if the bees and the monarch butterflies don't survive, then you're going to have the plants won't survive, and the land will become barren.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And it's she supports every idea with these like it's like. I mean, not like scattered leaves that all come from the same tree. It's magnificent
and
writing.
And it's very authentic. I mean,
it sounds so natural.
Yeah, you never for a moment go outside of it and go, oh, I'm watching a play here. You're completely pulled in. Yeah. And it's clear that the characters love each other. There's no question there's real love there, but they keep, speaking kind of past each other, and it's frustrating, and you're sort of in there as a referee going, as an audience member.
Yeah. Well, I have not been able to see the play because I was working, but I'm going to see it when I get back from this personal appearance.
I can do it for you now.
Okay.
But
my darling late wife's baby sister is right here in the studio with us. Maybe
sure,
you can play that part, can't you, Bonnie?
Yeah,
Bonnie can do
We've got 90 minutes.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, the play's called Birds of North America. It's playing at the Odyssey Theater.
And guess what? We have 5 tickets, which you can get for $75 contribution.
Yep, we have 5 pairs. We have 5 pairs available.
5 pairs.
And the Odyssey is in West LA on Sepulveda Boulevard, in case you didn't
beautiful
know.
Beautiful theater.
Beautiful space. And I just can't recommend it enough. And if you can help us out, you are killing 3 birds of North America with one stone. Because not only are you going to see a great play and terrific performance, your actress...
Jacqueline Masai.
Oh, she's beautiful.
She's fantastic.
She's physically beautiful and really beautiful acting too. She's just a wonder.
Great. And a Shakespearean. She played Portia in Julius Caesar and Puck in Midsummer with Independent Shakespeare in Griffith Park this summer.
What the Puck.
Puck. And she's fantastic.
Anyway, if you would like to see the show, it's running through November 19th. Yeah. It's running about 3 days a week on the weekends, obviously. And if you are able to pledge $75 to KPFK to help us get air conditioning and keep the lights on, and it's all tax deductible on top of it. So that's the third stone.
Wow.
Yeah, you get to get a tax
deal.
Break,
yeah.
And you'll see a terrific play called Birds of North America for $75. If you can do it, please do. And you can call the pledge line here, 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-5735. And then press 2. And then you will go down a trapdoor slide and where you will be held up. And you
into the Hall of Mirrors.
Yes. Yeah, so please do that. 5 pairs to see Birds of North of America. Birds of North America with starring our guest, Ari Gross.
Yeah.
That's terrific. And we have all sorts of other stuff, too, by the way.
Yeah, so we'll get to that a little later. But the fact is that you've had a long career. When did you start acting, and how did it happen for you?
I understand I had watched an episode of the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Oh, really?
It was about 5, and I asked everybody to come into the living room so I could reenact it.
Oh, okay.
I'm kind of making that up, but it was a thing that I always wanted to do. And, yeah.
Were you an only child? Or did you have...
No, I had two older siblings. My brother Mike's no longer with us, sadly. My sister Pam is a physician. She lives in Utah, as I mentioned.
Ah.
And my parents weren't in the business. I didn't really know. You know, I wasn't adjacent to the business at all.
Even though you were born and raised here,
I was. But you know, I think it was. At a certain point, L.A. was like entertainment or aerospace. My dad was an aerospace engineer.
Oh, okay.
I thought
– You were encouraged by them. They enjoyed what you were doing,
take drafting.
but it was the big industry. I mean, aerospace was
sure,
it.
Sure. Yeah, it was.
But what made your career take off?
Well, you know, I just junior high, I took drama classes. In high school, in the summers, I would go to the Teenage Drama Workshop at Cal State Northridge.
There you go.
It was a 8-week program, and from
the girls
8:30 to 12:30, you'd have different classes: scene study, dance, voice, etc.
Oh boy,
improv, a lunch break, and then. At the very beginning of the summer, you'd audition and be cast in a play. So classes in the morning and then rehearsals in the afternoon.
Wonderful.
It was a gas.
Oh, I'll
it's
bet
still
that was
going
fun.
On. I, you know.
You recommend it, of course.
Yeah. I haven't talked to anybody there for decades.
Yeah.
But I know it's still happening, and it was fantastic.
And did that any connections from that lead to your first professional job?
Absolutely none.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. No, it was worthless for them. None of that happened. But basically, I went to UC Irvine, and because it was because I didn't have to pay anything.
That's good.
But it wasn't so close to where we lived that I had to keep living with my parents. I could move out.
Good.
And Irvine was an hour away.
Yeah, you joined the circuit.
This is when the UC schools were free.
Well, not free, but
close to it.
You know, with a little financial aid. You know, I think I had to, do a job where worked for 5 hours a week on campus or something. Basically, that covered it.
My job was editing a radio show at Yale.
Really,
Yale Reports.
I did a thing very much like that. I drove a little Cushman cart and put the school newspapers into the newsstands.
Okay.
Yeah.
Communication.
So, exactly.
Right.
Communications. And I think it was the second quarter. I basically just started doing plays and kind of stopped going to my classes. And I kept adding theater classes for my ad things, whether I was in them or not, just to somehow pull it off that I could rehearse the play. And one of them was a production of Enrico IV by Pirandello.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Directed by faculty member Stuart Duckworth, who's no longer with us. And it was mostly graduate students. A couple of undergrads were in it. And Lee Shalit, now known as Lee Shalit Schemmel, was at the time the casting director and ran a conservatory at South Coast Repertory. She saw the show, came backstage afterward, and said to the group, you know, if any of you would like professional training, come see me when you finish school. And I went back to my dorm room and I wrote a letter to my folks and said that I had been scouted by a casting director from a major regional theater and offered a spot in their conservatory program, and that I was at the end of my freshman year going to start in the conservatory, and I'd become an apprentice there and get my equity card and become an actor.
Wow.
That I had decided to do that. And of course, she hadn't said any of that. I had a vision of it.
Yeah, you had a vision.
And about a week later, my dad called the RA in the dorm. Said, your dad's called a couple of times. You have to call him back. So he used to pay phone back then.
Yeah.
And he asked if I was all right. If
you're right, son.
Okay? Did you?
That's a little crazy.
Bike okay? Did you like fall off your bike or something?
Oh, really?
What do you mean? He goes, well, did you? I'm concerned that you bumped your head. And I said, what do you mean? And he goes, well, you sound like you have a head injury, that you would – like, what are you talking about? You're going to drop out of school and become an apprentice at a
– Wow.
And I said, well, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. It wasn't rocket science.
And I went to see her – that's right. It wasn't rocket surgery. And I auditioned for Lee, and she helped me –
Find my way into
the conservatory. And I went to the conservatory. She'd given me a huge scholarship, but I had no money to pay for the rest that I owed. And at a certain point, they started saying during the conservatory, you know, you have to pay something.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I'm here all the time. I don't have any money. But, you know, if you hired me, then I'd have some money that I could pay you back with.
Right.
And it just happened to be the moment that South Coast Rep was moving from a storefront in Newport Beach to that beautiful theater on Town Center in Costa Mesa.
Yeah, which I had the joy to work in.
Yeah,
as
it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And they hired me, and I worked for 3 years there as an apprentice. And
you actually realized your vision, didn't
you?
Yeah,
it was absolutely that, like, I'll scrape, you know, gum from the bottom of the seats, but they didn't have seats yet, you know? So it was a lot of painting and sweeping while the building was being built.
So do you consider yourself more of a stage actor than anything?
Not really. I mean, I love doing, you know, I love doing all of it. I love doing audio and film, what we used to call TV. Stuff that's filmed for streaming or,
yes,
you know, that. I mean, it's really the same, as far as I'm concerned. It's the same thing. You're just adjusting your
imagination to it.
You know? Well, it gives you flexibility, too. I mean, the actors are on strike right now, but you're able to work on stage.
Right, because it's a different it's under the
agreement.
AEA agreement, the Actors Equity Association agreement.
That's right.
They're not
strike. I mean, but there are challenges as well. I mean, you've been in this business now for so long. You've seen so much change.
Sure.
And we were talking about this at lunch, about how the stage scene has been dramatic, no pun intended, dramatically affected by the pandemic.
Sure.
And that the meat and potatoes of the theatrical business, which is subscriptions, have collapsed.
That's right. Yeah. Right.
And that's got to – I mean, how do you see it from the stage?
Well, you know, even before the pandemic, I was noticing that more and more theaters that, you know, even with big, you know, subscriber bases, you know, would still, even, you know, a good show with good reviews,
I'm sure
like, you know, Mick Jagger can sell out, you know, the Coliseum for a week, but ask him to do like a 6-week run of something and see how it goes. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not, but you know, South Coast of the Geffen, and suddenly you'd realize, well, after a while, the houses are like maybe 70%.
Yeah.
And, You know, there's been a big problem is that there's a generation of, you know, let's call it what it is, sexy boomers, who were used to going to the theater.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And it became – and it's part of like how you would live your life. And mm-hmm. A lot of younger – sure, there are a lot of younger people who go to the theater. Absolutely. But a lot who don't, where it's not really
– Primarily the theaters I go – I've been seeing a bunch of theater lately, and they're all gray-haired.
Right.
Really predominantly old people
going. It's part of the culture. And it doesn't have something to offer younger people.
Right.
Right.
But they just may not know about it. And also there's a financial barrier in so many theaters mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. you know, if you can stay in and stream something mm-hmm. or, you know – or maybe, you know, take a month of your earnings to go see some, you know, great performance somewhere. Well, that's where younger people put their money. And so I think that part of the challenge for the theater right now, as things change is and has been for a while, is how do you get more younger people
yes.
in the theater? Because it'll never die because you can't kill it.
That's right.
It's like the coronavirus. It keeps coming back.
Frankenstein.
That's right. Yeah. But it's models are not quite working the same way.
I wonder that. I mean, it sounds preposterous to think that theater could die because it won't. But as we identify with it or as we regard theater, maybe history, because it's simply you have an economy now where younger people who are not going are in a completely different mindset.
Right.
They don't have hope of buying a home and starting a family
right.
and going to the theater. It's, you know, they live in a multifaceted, fragmented media scape.
Right.
That is
and a
in
million
their,
options.
Yeah, that's in yeah. their pocket for the most part.
You know, right. my darling late wife, Melinda, did a lot of repertory work all over the country. Many of those companies have had to shutter,
yeah,
because they just
happening?
Don't have
the,
enough support.
The taper and
the tapers
and,
canceled and their season.
That's yeah. shocking.
So I mean, but you know, really, I don't mean to be pessimistic here, but I don't see how this is going to resolve it back to what we traditionally understood as theater, the way things are going, which is concerning because there's just nothing like a good play.
It's right. true. The storytelling is still essential, really, to the spirit and the nature of us as human beings. And sharing a story in a room with other people
maybe we'll cycle back. Maybe
the
post-social media, post-personal device generation will come up and see the isolating qualities of this whole landscape we live in right now.
Yeah.
And maybe they will come back together and appreciate organic contact.
Right. Right. Or, you know, I went to something recently. There's a company called Ghost Road. Mm-hmm. And they did a piece called Super Duper at L.A. Theater Center downtown.
Okay.
But instead of using a theater, they used all these spaces in the building between
like
the theaters.
Tamara.
Yes.
Mm.
And it like very roughly, it told the story of a now deceased artist, a recently deceased artist, who we never see, we never meet, but we meet a sibling, their lawyer, their manager, a competitor, a lover, etc.
Wow!
And the audience is split up into we're filtered into groups and given a kind of color. And so if you're turquoise or yellow or red, you're assigned you're going into this space and the lawyer, the manager for the artist would talk to you and then ask everybody in your cohort, and I think it worked out to like five or six people, certain kind of leading questions. And so everybody in the audience,
right,
you were in a small group, so it was – you were small. It was a small enough group, even though it was a large audience if you put everybody together.
Yeah.
People could say, oh, yeah, I've had an experience like that. And people could talk for a minute.
Oh, interesting.
And then
– interact.
Yes. And then you would – and then everything would shift and rotate and you'd go – so it was like a completely – It was a theatrical experience, but it was very different from coming into a play, and you were allowed to take pictures, and so it wasn't excluding, you know, these devices that, you know, we're all sort of addicted to. Yes, but you know, I think for a lot of younger people, it's become like. It's totally integrated to their operating system, right?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I've got my phone right here, you know.
Me too. I can't believe I haven't looked at mine in the past 5 minutes. And but the, you know, so maybe that show's not for everybody.
Yeah.
But you know, it's also possible the Trotany of the Wells isn't for like every 20-year-old.
Well, maybe this is what's going to happen. Maybe people will theater will adapt to people's need to reacquaint themselves with collective experiences.
And by the way, we do have another premium available, oddly enough, for $75 as well, that Ari is involved in. It is it's called a LATW pack.
LA Theater Works.
Of digital plays. And you've done a lot of LA Theater Works.
Sure.
Among these that are available is The Great Gatsby, starring Rufus Sewell, Exodus, The Shanghai Jews, featuring yourself and Joanne Whaley. I want to talk about that in a minute.
Great.
Lost in Yonkers, featuring you, and Barbara Bain. Oh, really? And Dan Castellaneta. A wonderful guy. I got to do a play that he wrote called For Piano and Harpo.
That's about, right. Yeah. Right. I remember.
Did you see it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It was great fun.
Homer Simpson, by the way, folks.
And All My Sons by Arthur Miller, of course, with yourself and James Farentino and Julie Harris.
Julie Harris.
What a cast.
Yeah, yeah.
Hubba,
yeah,
hubba. Amazing. And finally, New Jerusalem, featuring yourself and Ed Asner, the great late Ed Asner, and Amy Peets.
Amy Peets.
Now, these are
$75
for a set of digital, I guess, audio recreations of these plays.
Yeah,
for $75.
So you can wear them on your fingers.
Yes,
that's
you can.
No, that's not what digital
you can put
means
them on your
anymore,
phone right. and go all by yourself in a corner.
That's
and,
right.
And listen to it.
So tell me about this, the Shanghai Jews.
Okay, all right. I love this this story. So first of all, when I was a kid, my mom would tell me about Jews from Germany, Austria, who found refuge in China from, you know, Hitler and the
Nazis.
Right, right. And then probably when I was in my early 20s, I mentioned this to somebody and they were kind of like, I'm not sure about that. I thought, oh, there's another thing my mother told me that wasn't true.
Oh.
But
it was.
But as it turns out, there were 20 or 30,000 Jews who were able to escape the horrors of Europe in the late 30s and 40s because there was a Japanese diplomat and a Chinese diplomat, and I'm ashamed that I don't have their names at my fingertips because they are righteous persons.
Mm.
And they often with – against the wishes of their governments, wrote tens of thousands of visas for Jews to get out. The deal was, you know, everybody's passports were seized by the Nazis.
Right.
So you couldn't travel, but you could leave the country if you had a visa to get in somewhere else.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And so, as I say, 20 to 30,000 Jews made it to Shanghai.
Wow.
And it was, you know, and Shanghai was at the same time horrible. There was pestilence. People would die from cholera if they didn't pour boiling water over their food before they ate it.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, if you didn't strictly obey every order, you'd get thrown in jail for a week.
Ouch.
But in jail for a week was a death sentence because there was typhus.
Yeah.
And and it was a very – but people were not persecuted. And people for the most part said they experienced no anti-Semitism. There was something about the spirit there during the war.
It was Zionistic.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't so much Zionistic as it was entirely egalitarian.
Egalitarian. Mm-hmm.
And this play, Exodus, the Shanghai Jews – is based on survivor for lack of a better word,
yes,
testimony that's not. It wasn't just text. We have audio recordings.
Really?
Yeah, and. And
are they integrated into the show, or is it absorbed into?
They weren't, but Kate McCall is the playwright, and she created this piece for I think 8 actors, and not so we're it's kind of like Kennedy's children. We're all given, you know, kind of bits. There's not dialogue so much as you know, minute or two monologues that
kind of documentary style.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. And it, you know, there's like. The conditions before they went, the decision to go to Shanghai.
It sounds like getting, a good audio piece. Sure.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's wonderful actors. Anna Mathias is in it.
Oh,
and Alan
her.
Sherman and
Shannon
Cochran. And I mean, it's
did it start? Did it start a Jewish culture in Shanghai?
Not really. I don't know how many Jews are still there. But the thing is, even the Japanese soldiers, when they were occupying, at a certain point, somebody mentions the fact, like, you know, they weren't great, but they were, but nobody was singled out because they were a Jew.
They survived,
you know, and my guy, who's you know, who winds up being like kind of a beatnik in life, you know, a jazz fan, very like open minded in a way that, you know, we sometimes forget. You know, we sort of think there was an older mindset,
but true.
You know, we forget that, like, you know, Allen Ginsberg and Lenny Bruce were born in the
20s.
And he's more of that kind of mindset. And, you know, he talks about, like, you know, things were terrible, but the jazz clubs were great.
Wow.
You know, there'd be like a Russian jazz combo that, you know, was wonderful. And you'd see a Nazi officer like buying a drink for a bar, you know, Jewish bar girl at the bar. And it was this kind of zone where they were away from the war.
I wish that existed today.
No kidding.
And that's all portrayed in Exodus.
Yeah.
The Shanghai Jews.
And that's my guy's story.
You want to hear
it's
that?
Great.
Many others go.
Yeah.
Go ahead. So, Ed, you want to play something for us?
No. I was just going to say, but then you know, there's 7 other characters with these very unique, distinct stories of what their experience were.
Wonderful.
And I actually, you know, I received audio of this guy speaking.
That's
unfortunately
amazing.
He's no longer with us, but you know, it was fantastic.
Wow. So this is just one of 5 digital plays as part of this LA Theater Works package of digital plays that we're able to offer to you for a $75 tax-deductible donation to KPFK, who we are in desperate need of an air conditioner in this room.
And by the way, if $75 sounds like too much to you, for $50, you can get my narrated version of my book, Where's My Fortune Cookie, the digital version. And there's another here.
Oh, and you'll sign that, won't you?
Yeah, I'll sign. I'll vocally sign it for you.
Yes, yes.
All right. And there's one other incredibly bizarre and interesting offer. For $150, you can get Radio Free Oz, 60 hours of historic audio from the Pacifica Radio Archives. That was the origin of the Firesign Theater. Right here at KPFK in 1968,
wow.
Where Peter Bergman was a Wizard of Oz, and I joined him because of strange circumstances you can hear about in my book, Where's My Fortune Cookie, and the 4 members of the group, 1 Leo, me, 2 Aries, and a Sagittarian, no, 2 Sagittarians and an Aries, discovered we were all fire signs, and on we went to a historical 50-year career.
That started right here.
And hysterical as well.
Yeah.
Started right here. $150 bucks if you want to hear the origins of it.
So, yes, there's
That's
all sorts,
where
of, ways
name
there's all sorts
from.
Of ways you can help KPFK today. And to do that, call for any one of these items, 818-985-5735 and press 2, 818-985-5735. And
you
can also go to kpfk.org online. I don't think you can get the premiums that way, but you can certainly throw us some change, which would be
really, keep us on the
really,
air,
really helpful. And a holdover from last week, we had Lamar Waldron on back.
The Kennedy expert.
Brilliant Kennedy investigator. And his three books, which are incredible and fully researched and documented about who really killed JFK and why, he is offering as a gift to the station as well.
Oh, that's wonderful.
his three books for a $150 donation to KPFK.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And he will sign them, and he will also write in the book, he'll write whatever you'd like in the book as far as an inscription. And he's also going to write the names of his two top secret sources, which are not in the book. He'll write them in the book, so you'll actually have that.
Well, what will you do with that information?
Hopefully not get killed.
To track them down? Are they still with us?
No, that's why Lamar can now say their names. But they were like the right hand.
And are they names that we might recognize?
No, but if you read his books, you'd see that.
Oh, if you read his books, okay.
We're talking about the right-hand person for Robert Kennedy.
I know, Ted, that you've been working for a long time on a audio history of the death of JFK,
how it all happened. Lamar, and that's...
It's amazing. Ted has been sharing with me little snippets of what he's discovered and what they'll be talking about. And it's chilling, fascinating, scary.
Well, it's as far as getting back to boomers, it's the greatest murder mystery of the boomer age.
Sure.
And one of in American history. And people who may or may not have been around when it happened still think about it and realize how much it changed the course of American history.
Yes.
And it took it's going to be 60 years next month since the assassination.
Right,
and what's remarkable about it is that the truth behind the assassination is really only coming out now.
There was recently a guy whose book was published,
Landis,
the thing about the other bullet.
The Secret Service agent who's now 88. At the time, he was 28. And was on the detail protecting Jackie Kennedy,
right,
and was in the car behind them. And it's an interesting story, but I think the most interesting thing that he reveals in his book is that he admits that he and other Secret Service agents in the detail were out partying at what Earl Warren called a beatnik coffee house until as late as 5 a.m. Some of them were drinking Everclear, and Jack Ruby sent his strippers over. So they were a little tired because they were all supposed to be on duty at 8 o'clock. That's going to be in the story as well.
Wow! I wonder if he should put my father Tom Proctor in the story because he
did it.
He didn't do it.
Okay, good.
No, but he did know Jack Ruby down in Florida and had some kind of a business relationship with him at some point.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he's in the report. I have the pages.
I just want to throw in that Jacqueline, who I'm doing the Birds of North America with,
yes,
everybody calls her Jackie. And so nothing delights me more when I hear people go, can we get Ari and Jackie in here?
Oh.
Nobody knows what I'm talking about.
Well, our guest today is Ari Gross, who is currently starring in a wonderful play, Birds of North America, at the Odyssey Theater in West L.A., a beautiful story about a father and his adult daughter and their complex and yet loving relationship. And I can't recommend it enough. I just love it.
What birds are featured in your presentation? Great tits?
No great tits, but there's the tufted titmouse.
Oh, the titmouse.
We've got tufted titmouse. We've got plenty of nuthatches.
Yep.
We've got a mourning dove.
Doesn't everybody?
Yeah. There's a blue grosbeak who shows up, and I feel a particular, like, affinity.
Affinity.
For the grosbeak. And there's a cowbird. The only bird we actually see in the play.
Ooh.
Yeah, then there's also there's one imaginary bird. There's one bird that is spoken of, but it's not actually there.
Is it the porridge bird by any chance?
It is not. It is not.
Does
the
it
porridge.
Lay its eggs in the air?
No, it doesn't. No. But my doctor talked about that. Oh, really?
Isn't it? Yeah.
So if you would like to...
You're a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
So as we're doing the Kill Three Birds with One Stone promotion today at the here on the Pledge Drive, for $75, which is a tax deductible.
Yeah,
you can deduct those from your taxes. And $75, we have five pairs. $75 will get you one pair to see Birds of North America at the Odyssey, to see Ari do this wonderful performance.
Bring your binoculars.
It's good for theater. It's a wonderful time out. The Odyssey is a totally easy venue to get to and park at. It's just a nice, easy deal. And it's really an engaging performance. And I really highly recommend it. And if you can help us out, and help out the station in the process with a tax-deductible contribution of $75, you will get a pair of tickets to see the Birds of North America at your leisure while it's playing until November 19th. And to do that, call 818-985-5735, 818-985-5735, press 2, and they'll help you relieve you of your cash.
You know, the theater has air conditioning.
That's a plus.
Yeah.
That's
nice. Right. So I think they may have done a pledge drive like this.
Do you use binoculars as a prop?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I'm never without them.
Well, you know, there's a new invention now, trinoculars.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know what it does, but
I'd like to try them.
I guess you could see that invisible bird with them.
Sure. That's right. Well, if it's for your third eye.
Yeah. That's right. That must be it. Yeah.
I just bought a new pair of binoculars, and they all have image stabilizing now.
Oh, yeah, it's very sophisticated.
You can use them when you're drunk.
Fantastic. Yeah.
That's what the problem is, officer. I'm using my image stabilizing binoculars.
So after you're going to be doing this play through November, and do you have...
November 19th.
And so what it... I know you're on strike from the SAG, of course.
Or are you the guy?
Yeah.
Do you have any, besides doing picket line work, or do you have any plans? Or
I have a dental appointment later this month.
Great. Good. Yeah. Well, we wish you the best with that.
Thank you.
So, well, Phil.
I want to ask you a question.
Yeah.
What do you like the best? You know, you've probably done sitcoms, you've done films,
sure,
right? And you've done a long run in a sitcom and all that kind of thing. And stage work. What did you like the best?
Getting a massage.
Yeah, you think so, really?
Yeah.
It's something outside.
No. I love all of it.
I do too.
It's crazy. I love doing the play. I love working on film. On camera, I love working on a mic.
Yep.
I love doing readings with friends.
Yeah, I think everything that we do amplifies our talents.
Yeah.
And we learn something from everything we do. I don't care how
old
you are.
Absolutely. I love going and seeing stuff.
But stage production is really working without a safety net in some ways. And you were just talking before we went on the air about how you were doing a monologue at the end of the play, a pretty heavy monologue. And somebody in the audience, front row, their phone started ringing.
Oh yeah, that's a thing that I'm still mystified. The issue of learning how to turn the phone off.
Yes, the silent mode.
It's understandable. We've only had them for I think 30 years now.
Yeah, right.
There's a learning curve.
I always wondered, not being an actor, I just wonder about something that loud, 5 feet from you, because it's a small theater,
right,
ringing, and I think, my God, that would just fracture my attention if I was in that actor's shoes. I mean, how do you manage that? I mean, is this something you train yourself to be resilient?
Yeah, I think resilience is the thing, because it does fracture your concentration.
Yeah,
because it. Because it takes you out of it.
Right.
And instead of just thinking about what you're doing, it's the sound, primarily it's how it's affecting the rest of the audience.
That's exactly right.
And so there's a calculation, and it always depends on what the moment is in the performance, where you are in the play. Is it worth it? Sometimes –
Is it worth making an issue of it?
Yeah. Sometimes it makes sense to just hold – until they deal with it.
Wow.
Sometimes, and it's rare, it makes sense to confront it.
Yes. You can do that in a comedy much more than you can
in a serious play. But if you realize, if I do anything in this moment to address it, it's going to ruin the souffle will not rise.
Yeah, and towards the end of the play, it's very heavy.
Yeah. So you just try to preserve what you can of the play for the audience and move on. Because the fact is, it happens, sadly, almost every performance, but
really
not always,
yeah,
and not always in the front row.
Yeah,
in the
old days, it used to be a bad cough if somebody
oh yeah,
and it would go on for a long time
until
they got up and left the theater, to control themselves.
Well, Phil, it's time to get up and get out of the theater here.
Yeah, that's right. Right now, it's like a soap opera.
Ari Gross, thank you so much for coming on. And
really fun.
Thank
continued
you.
Success.
What fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Go see Birds of North America.
Please come.
And if you can help us out, go see by donating to this station, tax deductible, $75, and get a couple of tickets to see
Birds
of North
America. I may just have
North
to do
America.
That,
818-985-5735, 818-985-5735. And Phil?
We got to come to the end of another show.
And another show.
Well, I'm back. I'm looking forward to next week. I think Michael McShane is going to be our guest next week, who you probably know through Whose Line Is It Anyway? Well, we'll find out next week.